unfortunately, this bottle's not sellable. The mice got to it. The center of the cork is completely chewed out. There's maybe 5% of the cork around the outside and at the bottom. That's not complete. It's a miracle that it wasn't chewed completely through and evaporated.
So we got some drunk little mice running around.
Welcome back. It's episode 260 of Bourbon Pursuit. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny, and here's what's happening in your bourbon world. Drizly has launched a new program called BevAlc Insights. It's a new resource for data and insights into the beverage alcohol industry and its growing e-commerce sector. The platform launches with more than a dozen pieces of content, each geared towards supporting retailer growth and new articles to be released weekly. Currently available is a comprehensive hard seltzer report, a review of best practices for alcohol delivery, and tips on optimizing inventory for the summer. You can read more at bevalkinsights.com. Do you want to know how to date an old whiskey bottle? You know, like those ones you found in your grandma's crawlspace. Or, I mean, you wish you found. Some people have the craziest luck. Anyway, Michael Veach has a great new blog article on how he deciphers them. He first starts by looking at the glass and seeing if it's a hand or mold blown, which is going to place it in a certain era. Then there's the label, when the words straight, blended, pure food, and even imitation were used on the labels. Lastly, he looks at the tax stamp, because 1984 was the last year that required them. There's a lot of information here for those ultra-rare dusty hunters on Michael Veach's blog, and you can get that link in our show notes. The secondary market isn't new for most of us, but there's a pro and a con balance that comes into play. This week, Whiskey Advocate published their headlining article that was in their latest front cover issue called Inside the World of Black Market Bourbon. It looks at insta-flippers, the retailers, the counterfeiters, and even quotes from the bourbon podcast that you're listening to right now. This story really paints a picture to what most of us bourbon enthusiasts already know, but solidifies the statement of a broken system that still works. You can get the link to the Whiskey Advocate article in our show notes as well. Diageo has announced that we'll be building a new $130 million distillery in Lebanon, Kentucky, that will be the first ever carbon neutral facility. Bulleit will be the first and lead brand produced at the new facility, which will supplement production at the Bulleit Distilling Company in Shelbyville, Kentucky. That must mean they're cranking out a lot of Bulleit bourbon. This site will be powered by 100% renewable electricity with a capacity to produce up to 10 million proof gallons per year. In Bourbon Pursuit news, we did our Jack Daniel's rye barrel selection this week. Can you say Cinnabon? Oh man, was it good. We are currently projected to do over 20 barrel selections for our Patreon community this year, in addition to access, or should I say first access, to all of the Pursuit series. We're also heading into our next recording season, and we've got a lot of great guests and topics lined up. And we appreciate your support in helping us grow and sustain the podcast. You can get more information about the Private Barrel Club, all the barrels that we have coming in, and how you can help support us at patreon.com/bourbonpursuit. So do you have a really old bottle of whiskey? What about a unicorn that's coveted by every bourbon enthusiast out there? You could always risk it and sell it on the secondary market and ship it to someone after getting some form of e-payment, or you could take it to an auction house. We're joined by Joe Hyman of Skinner Auctions to talk about what it's like to buy and sell high-end bottles at a legit auction. We talk about everything from the bottles they accept, how they process the auctions, and how they even look for fakes. Every year, a whiskey breaks the ceiling for sales, so who knows what 2020 has in store. Have you ever wanted to get barrel bourbon shipped right to your door? Well, now you can. You can get access to their award-winning products right online. Go to barrelbourbon.com and click the Buy Now button. With that, enjoy today's episode, and here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. We're always complaining about everything today. In whiskey, we seem to be complaining about where something's made, whether it's sourced, the backstories, and listen, I'm as guilty as anybody. But there is a term on a label that basically would end all complaining if all distillers pushed for this in their own respective distilleries. It's bottled and bond. This goes back to the 1800s when distillers were trying to protect themselves from really bad whiskey that was entering the market. Basically, people were adding things to whiskey like prune juice and tobacco spit and all sorts of unsavory materials that doctors, they would get the whiskey and they would say, oh, this doesn't work. This isn't helping our patients at all. This isn't pure whiskey. So the distillers, druggists, and doctors all worked together diligently to create a piece of legislation that still stands today. And as I look at the Spirits Works Bottled and Bond California Straight Rye Whiskey, that's when I realized that bottled and bond, that is the terminology that if everybody went after it, if every single distiller in the United States of America said, you know what, let's focus on making everything bottled and bond, then that would end a lot of the complaining that we have about labeling. Why? Because that stuff is still rigid. But at the end of the day, it means it has to be at least 4 years old. So you at least got a little age on the whiskey. And it has to be 100 proof. So it's coming in at a pretty decent proof. Now, some of us want cash strength. Some of us want lower than that. But at bottle and bond, for many of us, it is the sweet spot. And it comes with the protection of the United States government. And you may laugh at that, but it still does mean something, at least in whiskey. And that's this week's Above the Char. Hey, if you have an idea for Above the Char, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube. Just search for my name, Fred Minnick. Until next week, cheers.
Welcome back to another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny, Ryan, and Fred going virtual today. And we have an exciting topic, which is something that we've never had on the show before, and it's looking at rare and vintage spirits and whiskeys and stuff like that, but through an auction house, right? I mean, we've talked about secondary markets before. We've talked about other kind of stuff, but this is something that is, when bottles start hitting, you know, 300,000, 500,000, even $1 million bottles, this is where the places like that end up happening. So I think it's going to be an interesting show. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, this is a world I have never been a part of or understand because we've done auctions, but not legal ones. And, maybe some raffles or, you know, mega balls or something. But I'm really pumped for this because, yeah, the only auctions I've been to is the ones Fred's hosted, which he's awesome at. But
thanks, man.
I'd love to hear how the big boys do it. You know, they do this for a living for all the time.
You know, one thing I'm looking to learn is like, why is there such a disparity between like American whiskeys and other types of spirits? Look, we all get in an uproar about pricing, but when you look at the auctions, the international auctions, like American whiskey is kind of like the stepchild. It gets very little action in comparison to cognac and scotches, which are going for hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases. So that's one thing I'm excited to learn today.
Yeah. And about wine. I'm like, why the hell is wine so expensive? You know? You only get four glasses out of that damn bottle. Yeah. You know,
a large chunk of the wine just moves from place to place. It never actually gets drunk up. some of the bigger auction houses, they have massive warehouse facilities, and they just move it from one place to another. And, you know, somebody who buys it today is going to sell it next year, and they just shuffle it around in their own warehouse.
Well, there we go. Let's dive into it a little bit. So you heard his voice already, and let's go ahead and introduce him. So today on the show, we have Joe Hyman. Joe is a specialist in rare spirits for Skinner Auctions. So Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So before we kind of really dive into, you know, auction houses and everything like that, we kind of want to know a little bit more about you. Like, how did you start like getting into spirits and really what eventually led you into this kind of world?
We were a Scotch family primarily. My grandfather, both grandfathers liked their Scotch. So I guess it came through that. And then as the story goes, my father was, I guess, overseas somewhere, and he found two rare bottles of whiskey back in the 50s. One just said very rare old Scotch, and the other one, that's all it said on the label. And the other one was Ballantine's 30-year-old, and he brought them back and gave them to my grandfather, who put them on a shelf and looked at them and waited for a special occasion to open them up. And then my father inherited them back when he passed away. And so what did he do? He put them on a shelf and he looked at them for another 30 years until there was a special occasion that came along. Somewhere along the line, they had opened up the very rare bottle, and he and some uncles killed it one night for a special occasion. And then the other bottle, the 30-year-old Ballantine's, it was on the shelf, and we were allowed to look at it, and we weren't allowed to touch it. And, eventually my older brother got engaged and cracked it open at his engagement party, and that was my whiskey epiphany. Before that, I drank a lot of Johnny Black. If I was with my Tennessee friends, I drank a lot of the other Black Label.
You could say it. It's fine. They're all good friends here.
Yeah. But I like giving a dig because it's like the biggest place in the world. So I just give them a little dig by not mentioning them.
Interesting. I want to know the psychology behind this. What's going on here? What's up with, what did Jack Daniel's do to you, Joe?
Oh, nothing. It's good. It's excellent whiskey. I'm just not big on a lot of hype type things. And when things get like too big and too hyped, I myself just kind of shy away a little bit. That's just my own little peccadillo. So I drank a lot of Johnny Black, and for a special occasion, I'd get a little bottle of Glenlivet or something, or Glenfiddich, and that was fine until about 1993, when we sampled this 1950s 30-year-old Ballantine's, and it was just a complete eye-opener, and I just started down that path. Once you eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, there's no going back. So, and most whiskey enthusiasts have that moment where there's an epiphany and it's just something different from what they've drank all their lives. And all of a sudden it's, I got to find more stuff and rare stuff. And back in the early mid 90s, like the bottles that are going, those 1960s and 70s vintages that are going for thousands of dollars today, were often $100 or $200 then, which was crazy money for something then. Now everything's just absolutely exploded. But that's how I started getting into it. And at some point I decided I really want to do this for a living. But a lot of the brand ambassador jobs, it's either you come up through the company or your heavy sales background and you're moving sideways from industry to industry. So it was banging my head against the wall trying to find something. And, just by happenstance, 7-8 years ago, Bonhams was looking for somebody, and that's where I started I called them up, and they were looking for somebody, they weren't looking for somebody. And that day I got a call from a friend of mine, who had just spoken to a mutual friend of ours, John Hansel, who was friendly with the CEO of Bonhams. And I called up John and I said, "Hey, I heard you got some men over there." And he says, "Yeah." And he says, "Yeah, because I've been trying to, contact them and they just don't seem very interested." So he said, "Well, let me see what I can do." And about 20 minutes later, I got a call from the guy who was kind of short with me. The boss wants your info right away. And it's like, it just got the ball rolling there. And it was, the rest is history. I spent a couple of years at Bonhams, and they decided they didn't want to do whiskey anymore. And they closed up, and I live in Boston. So I said, why don't I just, go local? It's been a happy move ever since.
Well, that's awesome. I think I kind of want to rewind back a little bit and touch on some things you said there. So, you had mentioned having that 50-year-old scotch for the first time and that kind of being the eye-opener. I know that we've all sort of had those epiphanies, but, did it feel like it ruined you a little bit? Like nothing else could compare to this kind of moment, and you kind of have that itch to find more stuff?
Yeah, that's basically what it is. You know, it's like anytime there's a first time, it's that extra special thing. And when you have an affinity for something, and then all of a sudden it reaches another level, then, you know, there's no going back.
Yeah, I think we've all had that. Like, Fred, do you can remember like what that epiphany bottle was for you that you kind of realized like, oh my gosh, there's so much more in American whiskey and bourbon than what I thought?
Yeah, it was Overholt. I don't remember the exact bottle, but it was a rye whiskey that kind of, and this was maybe 2001, 2002. That was, and what it was it just kind of like made me realize that there was a lot of flavor in whiskey. And this was before I had any inkling I would become what I am today and spend my career around whiskey. But that was like, at that time, I dare say I was drinking some spirits that I make fun of now. So, yeah, so that Overholt bottle was kind of opened my eyes, or my palate, if you will. But it definitely did not get me to like jump in the game of, you know, spending money on whiskeys like you have, you know, what you kind of curate, Joe. Like, what, let's take us through the process of how you get these rare bottles.
More often than not, I mean, just from having done this for a while and being around the whiskey community for a while. So we're looking at, you know, 25 plus years that I've been, you know, doing this and having, you know, being in whiskey clubs and going to events and other things that you get kind of a reputation for that kind of thing. And when I started doing this professionally, then it just carried over and people often say, you know, where do you come up with these things? And you know, where do you find them? And generally, my answer is that they kind of find me. Oftentimes, either it's through word of mouth that, oh, you know, you're the guy to speak to, or they've done very well with this kind of thing in the past. And people call me up and say, hey, I've got this bottle. And sometimes the big boys don't want to be involved in a single bottle or something like that, and or just not really attuned to some of these rare bottles that are out there.
And how do you get around like some of the we know about the like shipping laws and all the legalities of selling alcohol. What is it like for an auction house in terms of selling alcohol? Kind of license you have to have?
Well, in the U.S. to be able to auction wine and spirits, you need to be connected to a retailer, and you're basically piggybacking their liquor license to do this thing. And in cases of someplace like us, we had, and even Bonhams had a retail partner. That's how the stuff gets sold and out the door. Some of the much bigger places have their own retailer, a retailing branch, or even working backwards, some of the retailers started doing auctions. So that's the way it is on the way out. On the way in, it's difficult. You know, sometimes you have to go get it. And I'll do road trips around the country, at least the East Coast, and out to the Midwest and Kentucky and back. To bring in the things that, you know, they're too expensive to ship, really. And I wouldn't necessarily rely on, you don't really know how well the people are going to pack stuff. So sometimes, yeah, we had a guy with a bottle of Black Beaumont, and I specifically told him if he's going to ship it, he needs to, and he was using a licensed shipper too. So you have to remove the bottle from the box so it won't jostle around and damage the cork and the wax and all this other stuff. And you know, I always tell people, if it's in a wooden box of some sort, take it out, wrap it really well, and then either pack the box separately or ship the box separately entirely. And this guy basically just wrapped it in like a plastic bag and put it in some crappy used box and bubble wrap or something. And what ended up happening was it got to the, you know, the distribution place, and they said they could smell it. And they said, yeah, we can't do anything with this. It's leaked. It's alcohol. It's, you know, and turns out that that's what the guy did. And the wax was completely worn away, and the stopper had failed, and the cork had fallen in, and 90% of the liquid fell out.
Ouch. That's gotta be a tearjerker for somebody.
You know, and at the time it was like a $4,000 or $5,000 bottle. And, you know, he tried to file an insurance claim. And turns out that he never even clicked on the insurance for the package. and it's his own fault for the way he packed it also. Yeah. Then he drunk tweeted all kinds of bad stuff about us. And but so that's why it's difficult getting stuff in sometimes. But, you know, we do have a truck that goes out, does pickups for other departments. And I try to line people up. And, oh, you're going to be in California? Okay, I'll stop in a couple of places in the LA area, pick up a few boxes from somebody, or on the way back. If they're coming back from Southern California, they'll come through Arizona and New Mexico and Texas, and they'll make stops along the way and pick up a box here, a box there. And, you know, it just adds a lot. And, you know, we have trucks that go to Florida. Guys out in Chicago right now.
So you just got basically your own delivery service that goes out there and does it, which is pretty nice. I was thinking that
you have to do it, you know. So if what is it, the expression, if the mountain doesn't come to Muhammad, Muhammad goes to the mountain.
There you go.
I'm sure it's all free too, Kenny. You know, it's just part of the fee.
Yeah, right. It's got to be baked into it.
If somebody is going to, depending on where it is and how far the truck has to go to pick stuff up. Oftentimes the people just have a box and they'll meet them on the highway somewhere at a rest stop at lunchtime and hand it over. And there you go. All the paperwork's done ahead of time. And they just sign each other's copies and he takes the box and gone.
Sounds awfully familiar. Sounds just like regular.
Just like us.
Yeah. Parking lot handoffs. It sounds like pretty familiar. So I guess like I was thinking that, I mean, are there times when you have something that's like a super high dollar value bottle and you'll hop on a plane and go somewhere to like hand get it or something like that?
It hasn't really happened for me to go fly out and pick up a bottle, something like that. I mean, it would have to be pretty hefty to, for me to do that. But we've done other things where, you know, once upon a time I flew down to Florida and rented a car and met a few people over there and stopped in Atlanta along the way back and filled up the trunk.
Sounds like a pretty good trip then.
Yeah. One of those bottles was a old vat of Glenlivet 1862.
So, you know, your scotches pretty well, man. So it sounds like, so you're pretty well versed in the Scotch world. Kind of talk about how like American whiskey is. And if it is, like, how is this starting to play into the auction scene as well?
Well, the American whiskeys are booming, even in the auction world. You know, you've got your usual suspects that like everybody sells, the Pappy Van Winkles and the BTACs and all that stuff, and some of the Four Roses limited editions and you know, any of that kind of thing. Old Taylor Tornado surviving bottles and certain rare bottles that everybody's chasing. So that stuff is, you know, everybody can sell that because everybody knows what they are. It's the difficulty is when things get a little bit more esoteric to kind of figure out what the deal is. But, you know, we've been doing a lot with the older, rarer bottles. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are coming to me with them and to Skinner in general.
So what do you define as, and this is actually a question that's coming in from the chat from some of the Patreon people that are watching live here. What do you define as a rare bottle in your instance? Is it just something that's a limited production, or is it something that is, it's just got the hype built around it? I mean, you had mentioned, you know, Van Winkle and BTAC and stuff like that, but what do you all define as something rare?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily define those things as rare, but you know, extremely allocated. I'm thinking more about really old bottles, closed distilleries, things like that, that are extremely rare. And well, as we're talking about rare, I mean, it's a good time to pull this one up.
Yeah, go ahead and pull that up. So yeah, for anybody that's listening right now, so it's an OFC, but Joe, I'll let you kind of give a little talk about it a little bit.
OFC was the original product of Old Taylor. You know, Colonel Taylor came up with the Old Fire Copper, which is now called Old Fashioned Copper, but it was, and it recently revived the brand in the last few years. So if anybody's seen the vintaged OFC bottles from Buffalo Trace, this is the exact same logo that they're using. So this one was actually bottled, when was it? The George T. Stagg Distillery. It had gone through different iterations over the years. It was called the George T. Stagg Distillery, the Albert B. Blanton Distillery, at different points. Then it became Ancient Age, and you know, up till now it's Buffalo Trace. But this bottle was distilled in 1909 and bottled in 1919 at 115 proof.
Wow, just before Prohibition.
Yeah, must have been like one of the first, you know, last things. Actually, it says in the back, June 1919.
Wow, that's a beautiful piece of history right there.
And the fill level is amazing. The cork is pretty tight, and I've got the parafilm on it just to keep it safe. But and actually, the cork is stamped George T. Stagg.
Yeah. So that bottle definitely has some history to it. It was bottled over 100 years ago. What do you think a bottle like that's going to go for?
I think something like that would probably end up being 10,000 plus. At auction, just from what other more modern bottles have been going for. I mean, when you get into like certain rare rye bottles, like the Willets, some of the Willets by like, and let's say the Blue Smoke Van Winkle or Linnell's Red Hook at rye and things like that are going for $8,000 to $10,000 or more are. And you get something like this, that how often does something like this come along? Unfortunately, this bottle's not sellable. The mice got to it. The center of the cork is completely chewed out. There's maybe 5% of the cork around the outside and at the bottom. That's not complete. It's a miracle that it chewed completely through and evaporated.
So we got some drunk little mice running around getting into bottles.
It came out of Georgia, actually, a couple of years ago. A couple of young guys were doing a basement clean out. They came across a couple of cases of liquor, and there was a complete case of Old Oscar Pepper, distilled in 1911, bottled in 1917. And then a second mixed case was one more Oscar Pepper, but bottled in 1915, and then there were like three or four that the corks were completely gone and everything was evaporated out. And there was this one, and there was also a Weller dry gin from about 1910.
How often does that happen where, you know, you get something in and it's just ruined? Like you can't do anything with it.
It's less when there's like a single bottle. Or just a few bottles, but when somebody's got a larger collection, it's been in the basement, and it's been bounced around, then you're going to have evaporation, you'll have compromised seals, compromised corks. There are different things. We had a collection out of Texas that there was maybe a case or two of Henry Watterson's 10-year-old. I think it was distilled in 1914 and bottled in 1924, and there were a lot of evaporation. Pretty much all the bottles had significant evaporation. Maybe a third of the bottles had been, you know, evaporated out, and we popped open a few just to see what they would be like.
And what was the, they were what's, viable. What's the verdict?
They were pretty darn good. And so we kept a few for, as pour bottles, and we just bundled them up in lots of four and sold them off. And I'd take them to events, and I had one at Bourbon and Brown's in Kentucky a few, 2-3 years ago, and at a VIP tasting, and it still had some significant punch to it, even at, you know, 100 years old and significant evaporation.
Well, I was to say, what's the reaction of someone, then they bring you this bottle they think's amazing, and then you're like, nope, can't sell it. And then are they like, well, you're full of shit. Yeah, we can. Or like, is it, you know, do you have to do some mediating, or is it?
No, it goes both ways. Sometimes the people are like, are very appreciative of the time, knowing that the thing isn't worth anything, and you've given them a half an hour of your time to discuss it with them. And other times you get that too, where it's like, oh, that's nonsense. This thing's rare. You know, can't tell you how many times I get, I've got a 50 year whiskey. And yeah, it's, you know, Canadian Club from 1970.
It's like Pawn Stars. They come in, they're like, yeah, I got this old thing. They're like, no, yeah,
like, yeah, good try.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, oh, it's going for, it's, that's what they're getting. I know, that's what they're asking. You know, anybody can ask anything. You go into a high-priced liquor store in New York or Washington or L.A., and you'll see the one bottle of Pappy Van Winkle they got is sitting in the showcase with a $10,000 price tag on it. And are they getting $10,000 for it? No, not really. You know, by and large, those things are just you know, it's fodder for people to come in the store and gawk at it and then buy something else.
You know, I curate a good deal of auctions, and I've occasionally come across some fakes, some counterfeits, some from the eras of like the 1930s, actually. What do you do? How do you deal with the fakes, and what do you do when you see one? How do you spot them?
There are more craft distilleries popping up around the country now more than ever before. So how do you find the best stories and the best flavors? Well, Rackhouse Whiskey Club is a Whiskey of the Month club, and they're on a mission to uncover the best flavors and stories that craft distilleries across the U.S. have to offer. Rackhouse's box ship out every 2 months to 39 states across the U.S. In Rackhouse's April box, they're featuring a distillery that mixes Seattle craft, Texas heritage, and Scottish know-how. Rackhouse Whiskey Club is shipping out two whiskeys from Two Bar Spirits located near downtown Seattle, including their straight bourbon. Go to rackhousewhiskeyclub.com to check it out and try some for yourself. Use code PURSUIT for $25 off your first box.
How do you deal with the fakes, and what do you do when you see one? How do you spot them?
Sometimes there are telltale signs. And sometimes it's really hard to discern. And unless you opened it up and drank it, you wouldn't know. And even so, I mean, I've heard stories. I don't know what the truth is and how accurate it is, but I've heard that a lot of bars even are, you know, filling their Pappy bottles with like Weller Antique or something like that, and then selling it as 20-year-old Pappy or 15-year-old Pappy or something like, I don't know. I rarely drink in bars, so I couldn't tell you. And I'm not in that price bracket of paying for those things. So I couldn't say, but I've heard that happens, and you know, it's kind of shameful, but you know, I guess when money's involved, people do all kinds of things. But yeah, I've had some things where I told people, I don't think this is real. And they're insisting it is because they got it at XYZ auction house and they got it at some retailer or something. And I got, you know, I'm sorry, but it's not. I get McAllen 18-year-olds that have like, they're by and large it's the 700 milliliter bottles from Europe, and that seems to be those kinds of things. That's where it's happening more often than not. I mean, some of that stuff is starting to filter into the U.S. markets, and I've had to reject a bunch of those things. And you know, you see that the color looks like light tea or something, and it's supposed to be you know, first filled sherry barrels or something, and it's supposed to have a nice mahogany color to it, and it's really light, and you can see that they've tried to antique the labels to make it look older, because these are like 1960s, 1970s vintages, and it's just not right. So I mean, it's hard for them to, but you know, sometimes they realize that that's the case, and you know, they're disappointed, but there's nothing else. But more recently, I had somebody called me up. Can you authenticate these Macallan bottles? Because I think he's got screwed, and he wants to make sure that these bottles are still okay, you know, or not. And he told me specifically, if they're fake, then destroy them. He doesn't want them to filter back out into the market and have somebody else get screwed, which is, you know, great credit to him, because he probably lost 10 grand on these bottles or more. One was, you know, they're basically the really, known fakes, the Macallan Blue Label 30, which is like one of the most common fakes, and the 79 Grand Reserva, which is also one of the most common fakes. And those two were like really bad printing, and it was just, you know, even on the capsule, whoever faked them left the N off the Macallan on both sides. It has on around the label, it says Macallan, and then Macallan again, it's twice. So Both of them had the N missing, and whoever did it came back with a black pen and drew in a script N at the end of the Macallan. You know, all these things. The printing was bad. The color was bad. It's just awful. And the third bottle was a Macallan Anniversary 25-year-old. But as soon as I saw the bottle, I knew that, you know, the bottle shape was wrong. It had all the right capsules and everything, and the back label was right, but there's a special 7-year-old Macallan that's produced pretty much only for the Italian market. And instead of having the short, squat, bulging neck to the bottle, it had a long, slender neck. And the bottle was about a half an inch or an inch taller than the regular Macallans of that period. And I knew right away that it was a swapped label. And when I looked into it more closely, basically that's what was happening in Italy, was the mafia was getting a load of these bottles, and they were swapping out labels and then reselling them as Macallan 25-year-olds, which, you know, it's a $50 bottle turned into a $2,000 bottle.
Interesting that the mafia is involved there. That's pretty cool.
If they're doing counterfeits, it makes sense that the mafia would be involved in some way, shape, or form.
Has there ever been an instance where you guys have validated a bottle or thought it was credible? Somebody auctions it, wins it, then they open it and they're like, "This is not fake," and then this is not real, this is a fake, and then it's proven to be a fake. What would happen in that instance?
We'd give them the money back immediately. I started doing this 8 years ago professionally. And all that time, in thousands and thousands of bottles that I've sold, there's been one that I had to return for authenticity. And it slipped through the cracks by everybody. Actually, what it was a Van Winkle 4-year-old bottled for the Japanese market, the 1980s. And it was supposed to have a yellow cap. And this one had a black cap. And it slipped by me, and you know, I had never seen one of them before, so I didn't know one way or the other. And the guy that was selling it was fairly reliable, and he does a lot of buying and selling, and you know, he won't deal with certain people because of questions of authenticity and stuff like that. And he had gotten it from an auction house in Europe somewhere. And the guy bought it, and he picked it up. He was local, so it was easy. He started bragging to his friends about it, and they all told him, "No, it's supposed to have a yellow cap, not a black cap." And I contacted Julian, And he said, "No, it's supposed to be a yellow cap." So I said, "Okay, bring it in. We'll immediately give you your money back." But that's the only one that I've rejected loads and loads of bottles that nobody ever sees. But that was the only one that there were questions that came up about certain bottles, and if it couldn't be, you know, reasonably authenticated, then we've just pulled them out, not let them go to sale.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's definitely a tough game to be in right there, especially if somebody, I mean, is there times like that when somebody tries to play stump the chump with you and they're like, "I think this is authentic," and you're like, "No, and here's why." Like, how often does that really come up?
I'd say maybe 3-4 times a year. It's I got it from authentic place and blah 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 blah, and you know, and this guy with the 3 Macallan bottles, 2 of the 3 came from a guy that was got a reputation for buying fakes in Europe and selling them here. So, you know, he's on the persona non grata list at this point himself. And any of those people that have that kind of reputation, just like, sorry, I can't accept anything from you.
So, Joe, did you get on like the secondary markets and Facebook to kind of use that, for your efforts there?
Yeah, I was kind of wondering how you gauge values too.
Well, I try to use like a multitude of things. I mean, certain things like the Pappy Van Winkles, they have a very fairly consistent track record, so that's easy enough. But you know, on the other things, I've gone to Bottle Blue Book to see what things are going for there. I use Wine Searcher to see what things are going for retail, and I'll look at other auction houses and see if they come up somewhere else, and just try to get a feel for where it is. I mean, we're going to try to be a little bit conservative anyways, because it's better to under promise and over deliver than vice versa. But generally speaking, water finds its own level, and you know, on rare occasion, something will fall through and a guy gets a bargain on it. But you know, by and large, people that are coming to larger auctions with a wide variety of spirits pretty much know what the values of things are, and they will get to where they're supposed to be.
And then where do you kind of see, like, how does the market go up or down in regards of some bottles too? You know, you had kind of said that, you know, Van Winkles are pretty consistent, but you know, we've all kind of seen that the prices of them have gone up over the years, but at what point do they tail off, or do they plateau, or anything like that? Where do you kind of gauge that?
We haven't really seen that yet in our area. I mean, the last 10 years, things have just been going up. So it's like, if you've only enjoyed the good times, then you don't know what the bad times are. So, yeah, I mean, it hasn't really hit that point yet. I mean, some things have, I don't know if they've leveled off, but they haven't increased, they've slowed their growth, so to speak. Though in some areas with Scotch, it goes through lulls and peaks. You know, a couple of years ago, there was it fell off a little bit for a year or so, and then came back with a vengeance. And you had like Macallans, these rare Macallans were doubling and tripling in a year, and it kind of pushed everything else up.
What do you attribute that to? Do you attribute it to like just the rarity of like things just, you know, basically being found, or do you attribute it to basically maybe more buyers in the market? Like what do you think?
I think it's a combination of things where you've got the hype and you've got people that are investing, and they're not opening the bottles. They're just investing in them and putting them away and never see the light of day. So it kind of limits what's available in the market. So it pushes the values up. You know, I suppose anybody that hoards a particular item and corners the market on it is gonna set their own price at some point. But on the rarer things that people are opening, you know, prices keep going up because there's just not a lot of them available anymore.
What kind of, and that kind of brings up another point, like the kind of clientele that you all you know, talk to or cater to? I mean, is it mostly just for the enthusiasts, the whiskey nerds, or is a lot of people that are actually just buying this for an investment and never intending a drink, and maybe they're just gonna do what we had kind of talked about at the very beginning of the show, where you had a bottle on your shelf for 30 years that kind of just got passed down through the generations and you just looked at it?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of both. You get some people that are, you know, they want to buy them. They either they've got a special occasion coming up, so they want whatever, it's their 50th birthday or what have you, and they want to buy a birth year bottle or something like that. So they're going to buy them and open them at the birthday party or whatever. At the son is getting married, and you know, they want his birth year to open at the engagement party or whatever, any kind of things like that. Those things are the people that are buying them and drinking them. Then you've got people that are specifically collecting. They want every single of a particular brand, whatever they put out. They want at least one of them, and oftentimes they want multiples because they want to open them and drink them too. So, you know, it's kind of like antique collecting in the same way, where guy gets one, and it might be a beginner bottle, so to speak, and then he wants something better. You know, okay, this one's got a bit of a label issue. It might have a bit of a cork issue, and he's just looking for a better and better one to be his primary collector bottle, and then he can always open the other one. There's a lot of that going on, and you've got some people that are just buying and hoarding and hoping that, you know, it's going to be their retirement money somewhere down the line. Or we've had people on certain things will buy them here, and it was like very blasé about, you know, buying here and selling them in Europe.
There's actually a question that's coming up in the chat right here from Matthew, and he says, I tried to participate in a Skinner auction online last year and was blown away by how fast it went. Any advice for someone wanting to participate in a Skinner auction for the first time?
I would say don't have too many expectations, because sometimes things are just going to go crazy and sometimes they're not. I mean, you should look for things that you're interested in yourself. I mean, that's what I do. So, you know, I'm not chasing crazy bottles just because I don't want them. I want stuff I can drink. I don't want stuff I'm going to put on a shelf. And I mean, I have no idea what I'm going to do with this OFC. Someday I'll probably open it up at an event somewhere. But other than that, you know, I've got maybe a half a dozen or a dozen bottles that are just way too cool to open. And I'm buying stuff to drink. And is there that much difference between $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 bottle and a $200 bottle? Not necessarily. And that's where, like, the collecting and the investing is driving some of the market.
And so, I guess, like, another question I'll kind of have with that as well is, you know, because people come to you with bottles of, like, things that they want to auction off and stuff like that. And it never happens to me that, you know, you crawl into grandma's basement and you pull out a box of pre-prohibition, you know, medicinal pints or something like that. I mean, I'm sure you've had those times where somebody calls and says they have that. Like, do the butterflies keep, like, do they start building up for you, or is it just as just business as usual today?
No, I still get a thrill out of it. I just got a call from somebody out in the Midwest, and it was the grandparents had a liquor store or something like that. They retired 50 something years ago, and they just stuffed everything in the crawl space in their basement in the house they moved into when they retired, and it hadn't been touched in 50 years. This guy went crawling around in there for some reason and came across some stuff. Some of it's, you know, good, cool stuff, and some of the stuff is like crazy cool stuff. And he had a Mackey's Ancient from the 1940s that was in absolutely immaculate condition. And he had contacted another auction house first, and they said, yeah, we don't do blended whiskey.
And you're like, okay, we'll take it.
Yeah, $2,000-$3,000 bottle. Sometimes those things happen. I had somebody local actually did a basement clean out and found a case of Old Tom gin from 1917. And another auction house told him it was $2,000 value. And by the time I had seen the email or the voicemail was lost in my email system, and by the time I called them back a few days later, they had already made a deal with these other people. And well, I said, you probably should have like a $5,000 reserve on it because those bottles are $500 a piece. And they said, well, the other place won't go there. And then the other place wanted $700 to transport the case. And they said, okay, we had to have an easy out. So we broke up the case into three bottle lots, and we basically got $1,500 for three bottle lots. But, you know, sometimes those things happen.
And then I guess the other kind of question also comes in regards to like the new American whiskey market or like new bourbons. You know, we talked about, you know, BTAC and, you know, Pappy and stuff like that. But like, are there other things that you all find interesting that people want to sell? Like even something as basic as something like maybe like Elmer T. Lee or like Four Roses Limited Edition. Like, what do you kind of see in that regard too?
I see it a lot. I mean, we have stuff like that in our auctions. I try not to put out stuff that's too new just because I feel a little bit badly about getting into that kind of just a culture of flipping, but it's a necessary evil to some degree. You know, if something came out in June, I don't know if I would put it in an October auction just because I want it to be out there first. But you know, I get a lot of people when the BTACs and the Pappies come out in October, November, they want it in sale in February. And you know, I try not to do that just because I don't want to be in that mode of the flipping aspect of things.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it can turn you off.
It's a necessary evil in what we're doing. So you got to deal with it somewhat.
Oh, for sure. I mean, is there something that you look at as something that like, we're just not going to sell this? Like, is there something that you all just look at as, you know, off hands, it's prohibited, like we're just not going to sell it?
Well, it was an antique bottle somebody had. It was quinine whiskey.
Mm, yeah.
And we had, you know, there was a legal question about whether we could sell it because with the level of quinine in it or whatever, you know.
Okay, sorry, you got to talk to me. This is above my pay grade here. I don't know what is. Explain to me what this whiskey is.
Quinine is. It was like a medicine, and it kind of bridges the gap of just whiskey or spirit, and going into being something that's actually medicinal, not just, you know, prohibition era medicinal whiskey. It's actually a medicine.
Yeah, it's actually still used to treat like malaria. Prior, you know, it was one of the main treatments, and it was frequently mixed with whiskey. You'd also, you sometimes that bottle could have also had cocaine in there, you know. So if it was that kind of
right, like, I mean, this bottle was from like the 1920s or something, or teens, and we'd it one way or the other. I mean, if we had it's just the one bottle, you know, would anybody have sent anything? Probably not. But why risk it?
So, Joe, I got a couple rapid-fire questions, and I know Ryan's got one that's burning in his heart to ask you. Man, these are just kind of quick answers for you. What's the record for you? What's the record sale overall?
For a single bottle?
For a single bottle.
We sold the 72-year-old Lalique McAllen for $110,000.
What's the record for a bourbon?
For me, somebody paid $17,000 for Blue Smoke. Mm-hmm. At Winkle.
Yep. I remember seeing that bottle a few times on some pictures here and there.
And what is your cut of like, so if someone brings you a bottle, what's your percentage?
We have very high commission rates to start, but then it staggers down and it's tiered. So it gets lower. The more items, the higher the value.
So you're like a 90% commission rate?
Yeah, not quite. Rate? You know, it starts at 30, but I think a lot of that is to weed out the stuff that's like $200-$300 because we just don't want to have to spend the time dealing with a $200 item. And once you get into that kind of commission rate, then it's almost like not worth person selling it, especially if they have to ship it in. So once all is said and done, they might as well just gift it to somebody or drink it. Oftentimes, it's usually in the 10 to 20% on the sell side.
Okay.
Who is cooler, Scotch buyers or American whiskey buyers? Like, who's more of a pain in the ass to work with, Scotch buyers or American whiskey buyers?
I think it's about equal.
Okay.
Each one has its own thing. The Scotch guys are looking for something particular, and the bourbon guys are looking for something particular. So it's different, but equal.
And do the Scotch guys, do they like stick their nose up at the bourbon guys? Like, say, like, you peasants over there in American whiskey.
Yeah. I'm in a whiskey club, and some of the it's primarily single malts, and some of the guys are really whiskey snobs, and they would rail against bourbon or rye or something like that. But you know, once you bring out something like really good, an old vintage bottle or something like that, they acquiesce. They say yeah. And one of the guys who's been so vocal about his anti-bourbonism has actually moved on to drinking chartreuse of all things. At our last gathering, I brought a bottle from the 60s, and surprisingly, half the bottle went.
Very nice.
Yeah, I bet it. Well, I think, Fred or Ryan, if you have any other kind of questions, I think that might wrap this up as we start heading into this, because, you know, we've kind of got an idea of kind of the lay of the land of really what it is to, A, bring your bottles to an auction house, to be a buyer at it, the kind of bottles you're looking for. Where does American whiskey fit into this? And I don't know about you. I mean, I think, you know, Fred, you know, you run these auctions a lot of times too. And I'm excited to kind of see exactly like where American whiskey is going to go in this realm. You know, there are a lot of people that they're buying, they're hoarding, and they're hoping for the payday. And then trying to wonder exactly like, when is that going to be, or what is that going to look like for American whiskey? Because I'm sure that we still have a long way to go in regards of Scotch values and everything like that too.
Well, I'll tell you, well, one thing that, you know, we always want to compare Scotch and bourbon when it comes to these auctions. The one thing that bourbon has a stronghold is charity. I don't see nearly the amount of effort on the Scotch side and the auctions that you do in bourbon for charities. So, I mean, there are a lot of major national charities that are creating basically creating their fundraisers around bourbon, because bourbon has an audience that shows up and will bid and spend a lot of money. Scotch has yet to seem to break into the American charity game.
For sure.
We could teach him something.
at least we got something. At least we got a small win there. It's a small win.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So Joe, I want to say thank you again for coming on the show today. It was a real pleasure to kind of talk to you about, you know, again, Skinner Auctions and kind of how you got into whiskey. It was an eye-opening opportunity for a lot of us to kind of understand exactly what happens inside of auction houses and how things are really ran and really where the values come from and everything like that. So if you like what you hear, make sure that you follow us on all the social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, everywhere like that. And if you also support the show, go check it out, patreon.com/bourbonpursuit. So Ryan and Fred, cheers, and we'll see everybody next week.
See you later.
Toodles.